Dear Judy, thank you very much for your suave introduction. And in fact, I will not speak about the diary, but I have taken the word from Schopenhauer, one of my pet evening readings. Schopenhauer, who, for introduction, is telling prolegomena. Why? Because it's more difficult. We are in Ferenczi's study. We see him struggling for sincerity against hypocrisy, and he begins to write, later to dictate, his private clinical diary revolving around these topics. We can suppose that the urge to drive down these ideas is a manifestation of his profound preoccupation with his subject. As for him, psychoanalysis is not only a therapeutic tool, but also an instrument of the development of personal perfection. As a cultivated man of Central Europe, we can suppose that he knew well Socrates, who writes in his Apology, I quote Socrates, "The unexamined life is not worth living." An introduction to psychoanalysis. More generally, it is also a way to reach to the crisis which pervades the urban culture of the then Austro-Hungarian Empire, that of Vienna, Prague, and Budapest. Among the different isms, like Austro-Marxism, Zionism, nationalism, which was new in this empire, neo-Catholicism, expressionism in the arts, and so on, psychoanalysis is also an attempt, an ism, to find ways out of the then-present misery towards better future. There is a promise of a better future, of genitality, of happiness. Dreaming to be able to appear completely naked before Freud, yearning, as Archandor does, for, I quote, absolute mutual openness, unquote. He writes, again a quotation, "I believed that this clear as day openness, which conceals nothing, could be possible in the relationship between two psychoanalytical minded people," unquote. This openness would permit, he hopes, again quotation, psychoanalytical minded people, unquote, to become free and autonomous human beings. As for us, members of a subsequent generation, in spying on Papa Ferenczi, with all the joy and idealization and the idealizing enthusiasm of encountering a forever young pioneer, we also discover, little by little, mysterious weaknesses, depths, and abysses, in short, the tragic. Being human implies being as fragile as other fellow humans, writes the philosopher Emmanuel Levinas. He reminds us, moreover, psychoanalysis itself can cause fragility in its process of disrupting equilibria, that worked useful for a certain time, for a while. We see Ferenczi in 1921, 3 months after the death of his ambivalently beloved mother, beginning a treatment with George Grodek, a kind of mutual analysis. He presents a whole arsenal of morbid symptoms, such as a writer's cramp that had developed in connection with the manuscript of his genital theory, also called Thalassa, later in Hungarian, and in Hungarian Greek, an inhibition which will disappear in that mutual analysis with Grodek. Furthermore, he suffers at that time from pain, from pain in the right wrist, considered as arthritis, from the difficulty to breath, pain in the heart area, nocturnal apnea, seizures with a decrease in body temperature, insomnia, and the like. He engages in a mutual analysis in spite of his former contemptuous remarks on this subject. He qualified it as nonsense and perhaps tied to the fact that it was proposed by Jung. Until 1932, he goes back to Baden-Baden virtually every summer, often accompanied by his wife, by some of his parents, and even by some of his patients. His summer holidays are therefore no longer exclusively reserved to Freud. Apparently, he is continually getting better, a little bit, for a certain time. But we have to evoke here a mysterious, even eerie episode of 1923. Ferenczi's analysis of his colleague Elisabeth, or Erzsébet in Hungarian, Radoréves. It is a closely guarded secret. Her husband, Sándor Radó, later a renowned psychoanalyst in New York City, Columbia, is at the time training in Berlin and will soon work as a training analyst at the Berlin Institute. He has no idea of his wife's analysis in Budapest with Ferenczi. The marriage between the Radós has already been rocky for some time. It seems that they have not seen each other for 6 months. That is the research work based on the research work of Rosen, Paul Rosen. He trains in Berlin, she in Budapest. Moreover, Radó has also begun an affair with Helene Deutsch in Berlin, which has no escape their colleagues. There was a lot of Hungarian, Alexander, Teres Benedek and others at that time in Berlin. Suddenly, Ferenczi writes to Grodek, I quote, "Whilst undergoing analysis, Frau Dr. Radoréves died from progressive pernicious anemia," I repeat, pernicious anemia, "which she developed upon the death of her father, with whom she had a love-hate relationship. Her husband, who is undergoing analysis, writes Ferenczi in Berlin, didn't and doesn't know about the analysis of his wife. This patient, follows Ferenczi, moreover, was 6 to 7 months pregnant when her blood count was down to 600,000 red corpuscles and she was edematous. The doctors performed a section caesarea, which she only survived by 2 days, the child by 8 days. Let me add, on a trip to Budapest earlier that month, Felix Reich had diagnosed a severe anemia, but not a pernicious one. That was a kind of morphological definition, what a pernicious anemia is at that time. He didn't think that the prognosis is entirely bad. In retrospective, however, Felix emphasized that the psychogenesis genetic component to her dying was present. I quote, "The stone was rolling and not to be stopped. The marriage to Radu finished her off. I believe death had its shadow on her years ago when she was visiting in Vienna." That is the note of Felix Reich. Chronically disappointed, she finally gave up on herself, a course against which an analysis too was helpless. Obviously, these tragic events left a deep mark on Ferenczi, all the more so in that he could probably feel guilty towards his colleague and compatriot and namesake, Sándor Radu, and that the therapeutic choice analysis could not help her. He writes about the own state, Ferenczi's own state, at that time, I quote Ferenczi, "It was just before her demise that I experienced new heart symptoms, irregular pulses, and an intensification of my old insomnia, as well as my nightly apneustic attacks and drop in body temperature, etc. In a word, the death wish." So Ferenczi. "Despite this state, I still made a trip to Kassau, former Hungary, Kassau, now in Slovakia," writes Ferenczi, "where I gave 2 lectures. On my return, I continued with being ill, experimented with head bath, took up the well-proven stomach pressing, and even went as far as to reach for quinine strychnine pills." Clearly, the trip to Kassau did not put enough distance between himself and the situation, nor did the physical therapeutic measures and the heavy drugs he took. The image of an operation on the body of a dying or near dead woman may have revived old fantasies in him. The image of the corpse whose stomach opens up points ultimately to his infantile trauma when his head was pressed between the legs of a housemaid. In his diary, now I come to the diary, he writes, while telling the analyst about this, analyst Godek, about this, submerged myself deeply in the reproduction of infantile experiences. The most evocative image was the vague appearance of female figures, probably servant girls from earliest childhood. Then the image of a corpse whose It will nothing change, but it is obedience to my wife. That's a reproduction of infantile experience. The most evocative image was the vague appearance of female figures, probably servant girls, and whose abdomen was opening up, presumably in the in the dissection room. Linked to this, the mad fantasy that I was being pressed into this wound in the corpse, interpretation, the after effect of passionate scenes, which presumably did take place, in the course of which a housemaid probably, that is not part of her order, no? A housemaid probably allowed me to play with her breast, but then pressed my head between her legs so that I became frightened and felt I was suffocating. This is the source of my hatred of females. I want to dissect them for it. That is, to kill them. This is why my mother's accusation, you are my murderer, can cut to the heart and lead to a compulsive desire to help anyone who is suffering, especially women. The analytical and also physical treatment Francis received from Godek intermittently from about 1921 to 1929, and on occasion even later until his death in 1933, did lead to a decline in bodily symptoms and also to a somewhat freer stance toward Freud, as witnessed, for example, by Ferenczi's stay in America in 1926-7 against the express wishes of Freud. So, the cure was successful to some degree, and Chandler became somewhat more independent. But despite his increased self-assurance, he remained ambivalential and ambiguous. When he writes to Freud in January 1930, for instance, he boldly addressed him as a dear friend, only to take this word back immediately, qualifying it as a slip of tongue, of the pen. In the case of Elisabeth Radorevich, And according to the internist and psychosomatist, psychosomatic specialist, Felix Deitsch, the component of her dying was undoubtedly psychogenetic, or, in other words, the consequence of suffering from a steady stream of disappointments and insults. We are inclined to ask the same question in Ferenczi's case. His fatal disease, pernicious anemia, can be indeed viewed today, as far as we know something about this curious illness, as an autoimmune illness. It is categorized nowadays so, in the sense of a non-symbolical expression of a suffering of psychic order. That is to say, that it cannot be interpreted and understood as a bodily metaphor, as by hysterical or other neurotic manifestations, but seen as the silent suffering on the physiological level of a deeply regressed person. In Ferenczi's terminology, one could speak of a state of organic disintegration, the words of Ferenczi of 1932 of the diary, or of multiple fragmentations, splitting, or else, in Kleinian terms, of a fragmented self before the appearance of the paranoid and depressive mechanisms. Pierre Marty, in Paris, would also situate such a syndrome in deeply regressed cases with a prevalence of destructive biological tendencies. He evokes death drive, death instinct, mobilized by traumatism. They also see, the Paris psychosomatics, also see in it a defect in mentalization and what they call an essential depression, which would be characterized above all in a drop in the vital tones. Contemporary neuroscience and psychoimmunology would moreover underline the part played by the immune system. This kind of progressive disorganization leads to severe, deep-seated bodily symptoms. Engel and Schmale already spoke 40 years ago about giving up and given up in the sense of giving up because feeling to be given up. This sort of precarious relationship were very closely examined by them at that time. These more recent works show other possible ways of understanding this condition that the old-fashioned yes or no alternative concerning psychosomatic illnesses. However, some might argue that the multifactorial physiological background, B12 and folic acid, would provide a sufficiently pathogenetic explanation for some people, and that the hypothesis of a psychical influence would be superfluous for some other authors. For a long time, it was held that because there is no possibility of symbolic interpretation, it was told, it is not psychosomatic. In my eyes, that is a very illogical and simplistic manner to approach this question. But the jury is still out on this question. And I think that the psychic influence cannot be ruled out. Going even further, in the case of Ferenczi, there have been speculations from psychoanalysts that an unconscious identification with his deceased patient, Elizabeth, may have contributed to an unconscious choice of that particular illness. In any case, for Radu-Rebic, as well as for Ferenczi, a profound and deep-going disappointment lies in the center of their life experience. Indeed, Ferenczi senses that he is about to lose a major protective and stabilizing factor in himself, and thus not only his blood cells, but along with them also his inner powers that sustain his soul would be lost. He considered himself as, I quote, brave and productive only as long as unconsciously relied for support on another power, unquote. He comes to the conclusion that he never really became growing up, his words. Scientific achievement, marriage, battles with formidable colleagues, all this was possible only, so Ferenczi, under the protection of the idea that in all circumstances, italics in the original text of Ferenczi, I can count on the father surrogate Freud. Moreover, he writes to Godek, the underlying psychological reason for this decline was due, apart from the sheer exhaustion to my disappointment in Freud, about which you also know. And Godek confirms that it is the disappointment in Freud who makes you ill. Ferenczi adds, and now, just as I must build new red corpuscles, must I, if I can, create a new basis for my personality, and this at the age of 59. But are there other problems too, those with Radu and the memory of his deceased wife, past analysis? This secret, and perhaps the secret of a deep failure, might have having burdened Ferenczi, the man who so much wanted transparency and sincerity, particularly with the former members of the Budapest group. Why did Radu make frequent criticism about Rank and Ferenczi after the publication of the commonly published book? Ferenczi complained in his letters to Freud of the logical nitpicking of a Radu, quotation, and in one to Rank about half-baked criticism by people of Radu's ilk. That's also a quotation. Radu's attitude may have been by loyalty to Freud, to Abraham, to the Berlin group, and his analyst, who was Abraham. But the analysis of Radu's wife may also have left scars. If we take into account that Elizabeth Radu-Rebic's brother, close to the analytic circle, married to Franz Alexander's sister, and Franz Alexander at that time was in Berlin, we may also suppose that at the end of the day, everybody may have known everything. Let us remark that, perhaps significantly, nobody even mentioned the baby, except Ferenczi in his just quoted letter. And Veronica asks Ferenczi, whose child was it? It's a good feminine question. Thinking about his own analysis, Ferenczi writes, quote, Ferenczi, I do not know of any analyst whose analysis I could declare theoretically as concluded, least of all my own. End quote. In the hindsight, this non-concluded analysis can perhaps be completed by us with the hypothesis that the final demise of Ferenczi was due in part to the interference of psychic factors. As a conclusion, just as the diary opens by tackling the problem of sincerity, it also closes by asking sincere questions he was not able to answer in his unfinished business of psychoanalysis. Indeed, Ferenczi thus became one of the pioneers of psychosomatics, his own body being ruined by it. Somehow, the founder and finder of psychosomatics in his own blood.
Thank you, Andre, for this beautiful talk and thoughts and opening the diary for us in this manner. And I'm sure that we will come back to these ideas all along the course of the next 2 days. But now we go to the next page, and I welcome here on the stage Ken Robinson, who is coming from very far, Newcastle on Tyne, and he is a training analyst, a clinician, and he is the honorary archivist of the British Society, and he knows almost everything about our society, which one can really see the evidence if you open the pages of one of his last papers, which is entitled The Brief History of the British Psychoanalytical Society. But he won't talk about that now, or not only that, but he's talking about empathy, tact, and the freedom to be natural. Ken Robinson.
I'll sit. My paper isn't intended as an exegesis, but more as a tribute to the enduring quality of some key clinical concepts in Ferenczi. The seeds of this paper lie in the experience I had many years ago as an undergraduate reading English. I remember working hard on an essay on Daniel Defoe for a tutor I revered. It was my first piece of work for him, and I put together a state-of-the-art essay that claimed to uncover all manner of subtleties not apparent to the uninitiated. My tutor handed it back to me with a simple comment, "Very clever, but it lacks tact." And he didn't give it a mark. It was a distressing experience, but one I learned from, and I think I'm still learning from. My tutor didn't try to teach me what tact was. He indicated what it was not, and left it to me to get on to assimilate it working with him. So I was delighted when, training as a psychoanalyst, I first came across a discussion of tact in Ferenczi's paper, The Elasticity of Psychoanalytic Technique. and later his correspondence with Freud about it. I'd like to focus on two interrelated concepts from the paper and correspondence, empathy and tact, founded in the analyst's capacity to be natural and sincere. In different ways, I think they're the hallmarks of the clinical work of both Freud and Ferenczi. They are enduring and central components in the psychoanalytic act of listening. In his correspondence with Ferenczi about the elasticity of psychoanalytic technique, Freud bemoaned that he intended his own technique papers as essentially negative, as warnings about what one should not do, demonstrate the temptations that work against analysis. The obedient ones, he complained, didn't take notice of the elasticity of these dissuasions and subjected themselves to them as if they were taboos. He had left almost everything that is positive that one should do to tact. Although he agreed with what Ferenczi said about the concept in his paper, he was cautious too, since it was impossible to offer rules for tact. In the interest, I think, of promoting psychoanalysis as a science, he was anxious that tact should not be understood as a justification of arbitrariness, i.e., of the subjective factor, and I'm quoting from Freud, i.e., of the influence of one's unrestrained complexes. Freud had already used the clinical concept of tact in his published works, writing in 1923, for example, of the art of interpretation as requiring tact and practice. And the concept of empathy is central both to his understanding of how we know about the mental and emotional world of others by empathically recreating its bodily state through imitation, and to his conception of the clinical process. Following Freud, both concepts seem to have been common to those who had experienced Freudian analysis at first hand, so much so that they were taken for granted, just as Lipton thought that the real relationship was taken for granted. Ferenczi extended the application of both concepts. He, for example, foregrounded the curative aspects of the analyst's presence and recognize the importance of staying silent rather than re-traumatizing the patient through badly timed or inappropriate interpretation. Both concepts rest on being without pose, a phrase that Ferenczi reiterates in his paper. Only real empathy helps, Ferenczi wrote. The patient's sharp wits will detect any pose. In the clinical diary, he writes of natural and sincere behavior as the most appropriate and most favorable atmosphere in the analytic situation. And I take the word atmosphere to mark out being natural and sincere as not so much a concept as an environmental provision. Taking together empathy, tact, and being natural speak of the analyst's freedom to use himself beyond the level of consciousness in the process of analysis. His bodily self in empathy, his unconscious as a receiving instrument for the patient's unconscious, his evenly suspended attention as complementary to the patient's free association, and so on. Together they form the basis for elasticity and the analyst's readiness to yield like an elastic band to the patient's pull, without ceasing to pull in his own direction. Especially in the realm of transference, where the analyst has to be willing to be pulled towards occupying a particular transference role so as to be able to recognize it, whilst pulling back from it sufficiently so as not to occupy it. What is tact? Asked Ferenczi. Both Ferenczi and Freud thought tact was an ability to know intuitively how, if, and when to intervene. Sorry, my technology. Ferenczi saw it as the capacity for empathy, and Freud, I think, would not have disagreed. In fact, there's very little disagreement on the fundamentals in their letters about Ferenczi's paper, except for the question of how to reconcile the subjective factor with psychoanalysis's claims to science. Freud thought that tact involved a weighing out, which remains mostly preconscious, of the various reactions that we expect from our interventions. It is first and foremost, I'm still quoting, a matter of the quantitative assessment of the dynamic factors in the situation, rules for these measurements, he believed, could naturally not be made. The analyst's experience and normality will be the decisive factors. Ferenczi broadly agreed, but reacting to Freud's caution, understood what Freud called normality as properly being analysed, arguing that where this is the case, the subjective factor can be diminished to the point of being removed. The full implications of their correspondence are not easy to grasp. Freud's caution is no doubt personal as well as political. He probably equates a subjective factor and the influence of one's own unrestrained complexes because he is anxious about and critical of Ferenczi's practice. Ferenczi, in his turn, defensively makes rather grandiose claims for training analyses, and Andre Heinold has just mentioned the unfinished analysis of Ferenczi himself. But their debate nevertheless highlights a problem that neither could find a solution to. Between Ferenczi's sense of the analyst's personal analysis promoting common tactical and technical measures, which ensure common objective conclusions in the observation and treatment of the same psychological raw material, quotation, and Freud's sense that it is impossible to formulate rules by which tact operates, lies the problem of personal knowledge. And here, another Hungarian, the philosopher Michael Polanyi, a contemporary of Ferenczi in Budapest, comes to their aid. The problem that Ferenczi and Freud were wrestling with is also a paradox in Plato's Meno, and here is how Polanyi stated it. The Meno shows conclusively that if all knowledge is explicit, that is, capable of being clearly stated, then we cannot know a problem or look for its solution. And the Meno also shows, therefore, that if problems nevertheless exist and discoveries can be made by solving them, we can know things and important things that we cannot tell. Knowing, according to Polanyi, comprises two types of awareness, the subsidiary and the focal. They are experientially mutually exclusive, but inseparable in the act of knowing. Focal awareness concerns the conscious object of our attention, but all focal awareness is dependent on subsidiary awareness. We attend focally to the object of our attention while dwelling subsidiarily in a variety of clues that stand in the background and make attending to the focal target possible. The integration of these two kinds of awareness occurs in any act of knowing. What we hold subsidiarily represents an extension of our bodies, and because this aspect of tacit knowing is rooted in the body and extends out from it, all thought is rooted in the body. Thus, our body is the ultimate instrument of all our knowledge, whether intellectual or practical. In this extension of the body, in the process of knowing, we live, says Polanyi, in the tools and probes which we use, and likewise in our intellectual tools and probes. Clinical tact is such a tool, and so too is empathy, experienced at the level of the bodily self. Tacit knowing requires the continued integrating participation of the knower. Can one possibly teach tact and empathy, asked Michael Balint. Both Ferenczi and Freud thought it possible, as did Balint himself, and they recognise it is more likely that tact and empathy, and with them naturalness, flexibility, and a bearing that is both personal and professional, will be learned not from reading papers, but will be passed on from analyst to analyst. They do not account for how this happens, however. Polanyi, again, is helpful in understanding this process of transmission. For Polanyi, the act of knowing is learned by apprenticeship and practice within tradition, shared by a community. This is precisely how Edward Glover described his analysis with Karl Abraham in Berlin in 1922. Polanyi emphasizes practice over precept. Rules of art, he writes, can be useful, but they do not determine the practice of an art. They are maxims which can serve as a guide to an art only if they can be integrated into the practical knowledge of the art. As Kant pointed out, no system of rules entails how and when to apply them. That can lead to inscrutable mother wit, of which psychoanalytic tact is one instance. Ella Sharp made a similar point when she warned trainees that psychoanalysis ceases to be a living science when technique ceases to be an art. And in Polanyi's view, we learn how to do something by doing it. Only then are we in a position to understand and apply rules. But he asks, how then can we practice if we do not know how to? His answer is by submission to a master as an apprentice. To learn by example is to submit to authority. You follow your master because you trust his manner of doing things, even when you cannot analyze an account in detail for its effectiveness. By watching the master and emulating his efforts in the presence of his example, the apprentice unconsciously picks up the rules of his art, including those which are not explicitly known to the master himself. These hidden rules can be assimilated only by a person who surrenders himself to that extent uncritically to the imitation of the other. The trainee analyst's first chance to assimilate technique in this way is from his analyst. Later he goes on to learn from the process of supervision, as he experiences supervisors handling material in their particular psychoanalytic ways. Polanyi thinks of this immersion in a practice that the trainee does not yet understand as dwelling in it until such time as its meaning is discovered by hitting on the same kind of indwelling as the teacher is practicing. The apprentice learns not only how to practice an art, but an attitude and bearing towards it. Is not only a process of learning how to analyze, but of taking in what it is to be an analyst. Now, Polanyi's emphasis on learning within a tradition and community is not a recipe for obedience to institutional power, but carries with it a respect for radical progress, not simply in terms of descent from tradition, but in terms of his recognition that each age, or perhaps each particular participant in that tradition, reinterprets it, as T.S. Eliot also recognized. Ella Sharp spoke on the same theme for psychoanalysis when she argued that we cannot hand on technique, for it depends upon other factors that outweigh the conscious application of someone else's rules and regulations. Every generation of psychoanalysts, she writes, will have to evolve it for themselves and from scratch. One has to tread Freud's path after him, start as he started, not where he left off. And we see this radical progress in action in Ferenczi's relation to Freud. Polanyi's exposition of tacit knowing confers epistemological respectability on the analyst's connoisseurship in the psychoanalytic process and the process itself. On listening, on the hunch or intuition, which Freud stressed had led to his most momentous discoveries, and on tact. Edward Glover Englished tact, T-A-K-T, the German tact, as a sense of touch. To keep in play, it's German, and I believe from Judith, Hungarian, connotation of musical timing. As it happens, Polanyi cites the pianist touch as an instance of connoisseurship that cannot be analyzed into its constituent parts and then practiced. Touch is fundamentally different from technique, at least insofar as the latter is understood as capable of being codified. Touch is acquired by indwelling in a training that allows the pianist or analyst to experience the tacit integration of rules, or better, ways of approaching the task in hand. In that integration, which involves a reinterpretation of the tradition's concept and attitude towards touch and rules, lies personal knowledge and skill. Technique informed by such indwelling becomes irreducible to prescriptions. How important it is to remember that in 2013, when it's sometimes suggested that psychoanalytic-oriented psychotherapy can be manualized. By way of a footnote, I suggested that there are not major differences between Freud and Ferenczi in the area of empathy, tact, and being natural, and not everybody might agree with that. I don't want to diminish the differences in other areas, nor am I ignoring that throughout the diary, Ferenczi is critical of Freud, and that his criticism extends to Freud's rigidity and failure to be natural. But as Judith Dupont points out, the diary must be read as part of Ferenczi's analysis with Freud. Not all Freud's analysands would have agreed. In the consulting room, John Dorsey wrote, Freud lived himself naturally. He seemed to be his only technique. Reading Freud's contribution to the debate is equally difficult, because he is quite consciously framing his remarks in the light of his political agenda to promote psychoanalysis as a science, as he was in his published work. And to make matters even more problematic, recent research has underlined the gap between the official version of psychoanalytic practice in his published works and his actual practice, so that when, for example, Pigman, in his excellent discussion of empathy in Freud, or the concept of empathy in Freud, writes, perhaps the most striking aspect of Freud's conception of empathy is his emphasis on its intellectual features and his relative neglect, even suspicion, of its affective ones, we have to be careful not to turn this too readily into a distinction between Freud and Ferenczi's nuancing of the concepts under discussion. By way of conclusion, however we read the debate, it refocuses key concepts whose epistemological importance Polanyi clarifies. If we accept Polanyi's account of the process of learning in a community as a basis for radical progress, we might also wish to reflect on how well our own societies and institutions foster an atmosphere in which candidates, through rigorous training, can find their own way and become inward with their task as analysts, free from authoritarian pressure to conform, so that they may drop any pose and be free to be natural within their own role as an analyst. All too often, as Kernberg wrote more than a decade ago, training institutions show a lack of consistent concern for the total educational experience of candidates and subject them to authoritarian management, which are anathema to the freedom to be natural. As Kernberg put it in the last of his ironic 30 ways to destroy the creativity of psychoanalytic candidates, number 30, keep in mind, this is an advice to what to do in an institution with candidates to destroy them. Keep in mind, when uncertain about dangerous developments, this is quite interesting in terms of Ferenczi and Freud, actually. Keep in mind, when uncertain about dangerous developments that may challenge proven methods by inhibiting the creativity of candidates, that the main objective of psychoanalytic education is not to help students to acquire what is known in order to develop new knowledge, but to acquire well-proven knowledge regarding psychoanalysis to avoid its dilution, distortion, deterioration, and misuse.
Thank you, Ken. It's really wonderful, and you made me think again and again how talks begin to intertwine and start to talk to each other, and maybe it's just a sign that we all obey to one of the masters which shape the texture also of such conferences, which is the unconscious. So on the third page, I invite Gábor Szörnyi, who comes from Budapest. He's a training analyst. He was the former president of the Hungarian Society. And I also have to confess that we are analytical siblings, because we were the students of Tibor Rajka, another figure of the Hungarian pre-war society and the Budapest school, who deserves remembering. So come, Gábor, and talk about the challenges of honesty.
I move also.
Okay, now it's going. So thanks for the invitation for Judith. Maybe it's I have to thank it for our history, actually, because I have to be honest and say that I am not an expert on Ferenczi and have never been. And well, I feel myself a bit as a cuckoo in the nest today and yesterday. However, I belong to those people and to the group of those people who read Ferenczi just for joy. And I try to come from this point and hope that anyhow I will converge a bit to what has been told. Well, no problem. I go on anyhow, and when I read Ferenczi first time, yes, the first thing by reading what hit me was his notion about the hypocrisis of the doctor. And when I read it, then I started to think about it, and then I started to look at myself, and I had to see that, well, I am hypocritical day by day and minute to minute in my therapy. So after a time, I was a bit upset and want to give it up to look after how my honesty is working. And then I tried to look at it from the point of view of the doctor, who could say that, okay, you expect from me something which is impossible, which is impossible for many ways. And it was mentioned also today that among others, it's impossible because you have your own internal personal private limits, which Freud and also Ferenczi tested. On the other hand, that you can never be really secure whether you were honest to yourself or not. And from that point on, it's the impertinence of psychoanalysis to require from everybody who is working in this field, be honest during your work. And that is one of the reasons why psychoanalysis can be upsetting, actually. And to me, Ferenczi tried to experience being honest to its utmost limits, to be honest without limits. And the mutual analysis is also, from that point of view, a part of the experimenting with being as honest as I can in a situation, actually, with the patient, when it was about these mutual experiments, to whom it's also a question why I should be honest. So it's the honesty to myself, it's honesty to the situation, the honesty to being together, or it's the honesty to the other person. And, please. And this way, if you look at honesty, then it's the impossibility. It is that you try to be honest. And during analytic training, one of the competencies or capacities which we try to develop is the quantity to be honest. And it's always also about the willingness to be honest and being in the therapeutic session. It's also a question how much I am willing to be honest again and again and again and again. And maybe that's one other competence, the ethical solidity on the micro level, which could help us to regain our honesty, but which is always an internal fight. And in that way,
It's also in the, you spoke about the training and training, what training brings. And maybe one aspect is that self-analysis was at the beginning some requirement for the beginning of the analysis, becoming an analyst. And nowadays, it's one of the most important assessed capacities or competencies and the end of the analytic training, how much the persons are able for self-analysis when you make the assessment. Also at the East European Psychoanalytic Institute for Eastern Europe, where we also try to work with some kind of equivalency procedures. The assessments are very important, how we find out what something someone is able to do. And there are three major parts where we can test and experiment with our capacity for honesty and self-analysis. One of them is when we are in analysis. And it's quite clear. And in retrospect, I think that all of us can say that we were not honest enough. And when we think we would like to continue or to repeat our analysis, one of the questions is, notions is that now I will be much more honest than I used to be. And the other one is when we are doing analysis. And when doing analysis, of course, it's always this double-sided of being honest. One of them is the internal part, which is our private way of being honest. The other one is the interactional part, how honest we are. And there is again the problem that we do not know how honest we are, because we can somehow get over about our thinking, what we tell, how honestly we say something, but we never know how our behavior, how honest it is. And there is always some kind of distance between these two types of honesty. And the third one is being in supervision, where we have a second opportunity to be honest, at least on our patients and our therapeutic relationship in the present of someone else. And this is again a very different type of being honest. And from this, please go on. We have always very different limits of this honesty, which is also very important to face it. Of course, internally it's our privacy, how honest we can be. In doing analysis, it was, you spoke very nicely about tactfulness, and it's about bearable and unbearable of honesty as well, or unbearable realities. And in supervision, it's always this critical play between analysis, personal analysis and supervision, how honest, and where we can be, and about what we can be honest. But nowadays, a major part of our training goes on also in groups, where group discussions and group case discussions, in which being honest has a very different type of limits, and where it has very different risks. And what in yesterday evening Berman spoke about, these virtual groups and virtual relationships, we can call them also shadow relationships which people have together, they make a real limitation of the reality and of the honesty, please. It's just a very simple vignette. A colleague in second analysis, we address each other on first name, which is not the way for me in doing analysis with patients. You must know in Hungarian, the change is when we call someone first name, then it's the second person in singular. When we go back, then it's third person singular. So it's really distinct. She speaks about the mother that she used to tell her, "You will be never able to find such a man as your father." I start to say that the mother's message must have been also, "You could never compete with me, who was able to be in your father," but unwittingly changed from addressing her own first name. Both of us immediately perceive my slip of tongue. I am perplexed, but without any other stronger emotions, try to find quickly some explanation. She interprets the event that I made a patient of her. Some truth is in it, I feel, but still have no idea why it happened, that I also share with her. She also says that this topic has been worked through sufficiently for her in the previous analysis. Almost subliminally, I feel myself refused. And actually, from that point, things start. What is in me? What is with me? What happens between us? What we do together? What happens in her? And if we go in these directions, it is very different when I try to go on in myself, I try to go on in a supervision situation, or I try to go on in a group discussion where I expose myself all other associations which are there present. Just to go to end. And in my view, there is a slow change in the last decades in the clinical analytic culture. What I mean with that is that if you go to the different conferences, trainings, and so on, then you sit more and more in small groups, in small group discussions, where you train yourself and each other to speak freely in an associative, honest way. And with that, I think something more is developing. That there is also a change from the, let's call it, confusion of theoretical tongues to the common language of case discussion, where people speak very differently, and where you meet other people and you train yourself in speaking this way. But it's not just that, but I think that it helps two things. One of them is that somehow the psychoanalytical way of the clinical way of behaving gets more and more shared, while there is more and more fears that it gets diluted or go lost. And in the Psychoanalytic Institute in Eastern Europe, for instance, there are also opportunities that teacher present the cases in a way where candidates and also new members are in the small group and discuss with the presenter in a way that is an analytic case discussion which can take 4 hours a session, so that people develop something which I think that we do not see yet, what it can bring in the way we will develop further. The other point from that is that somehow there is also this development that not just small groups are used, but also just quite institutes. I mean, like the training colloquium of the European Psychoanalytic Federation, usually held in December, where Tuckett, for instance, developed his frame, or where there is this end-of-training evaluation project, where people sit in small groups where they work associatively, and from that they try to bring together something which is a bit more than the person who started to present the case was present. So somehow I hope that it also helps to use the psychoanalytic method more and more as a real research tool, which is able to gain out what we have inside when we sit together with the patient, but what we cannot share with each other. And, well, that's that. And then to close also on this group line, that when I yesterday heard again about speaking about small groups, there was mentioned one small group. It was the small group of the patient of Ferenczi. And then when I looked at the picture and I saw a bunch of pretty women, then I was a bit perplexed what's about. And then I start to imagine if Ferenczi would sit here listening to us, how we see him through his patients, how would he feel and what would he say? And then I started also to imagine how it would be if my patients would try to somehow give the picture about myself and what I felt that I plead for their benevolence. So, thank you.
Thank you, Gábor, very much. I think it's also the spirit of the Budapest school that we start late. So we have to try and use our time as best as we can. So I give it over to you.
Just a word. Yes, just a word about empathy. Sir, while you were speaking about 10 minutes ago, I started to think about my patients. And I was saying to myself, well, I might make a speech on my successes, but on my failures, they should speak about it. And I was just numbering them. What should they say about my failures?
Hi, Giselle Gardner, New York. Thank you so much for this wonderful panel. All three of the papers were very, very interesting and very stimulating. I was particularly moved by André Hainaut's paper and two things. I wish we had more time to talk about it. The number one thing is you're tracing psychosomatic development to a very, very early phase in traumatization, the fragmentation of the personality, extremely important points. The other thing is a very moving account of the tragic fate of Elisabeth Radó-Reves and her treatment by Ferenczi. Very moving account. And the affinity between these two tragic figures, that they both died of pernicious anemia, and the similarities between their cases and the secrets that were surrounding of the treatment of Elisabeth Reves. You stress, André, you stress the guilt that must have been evoked in Ferenczi about this treatment. The other thing that I was just wondering about is possibly another emotion that's probably closer linked to an earlier traumatization, which is shame. If you think about Sándor Radó was a very junior figure in the Budapest school and a great admirer of Ferenczi at the very early phases of his career. And in a way, he put Ferenczi on the pedestal at the very early stages of his involvement with the Budapest school. And then, of course, then he left for Berlin and onto different paths. But I was just wondering if, in fact, this idolization of Radó, of Ferenczi, then also led to Ferenczi's great anguish about the failure of this treatment of Elizabeth and or the tragic result of Elizabeth's faith. And possibly a connection of shame to this particular case. Just was wondering about that.
Jonathan Scott, London. What a wonderful morning's work. I wanted to pick up something that Ken Robinson was saying about watching the master, the analysand watching the master analyst. And I think that there's a problem with learning the craft in that way, because it's far too easy to learn the rules of being an analyst by doing what your analyst did. A very simple example would be, how do you give the bill to your patient? And if you learn how to do it because that's the way your analyst did it, then you might really be leaving out the authenticity of how you would do it when you become your own self as the analyst. So one needs to have a much more critical thinking about the apparent rules that one grew up with in one's own analysis versus the authenticity of how one would do it oneself. And I'm sure you agree with that. The other thing that struck me very much was you talked about musical touch. And in relation to the depth of psychosoma, I think perhaps one of the earliest bits of psychosoma is the voice of the mother and the hearing of the baby. And the primitiveness of that, I think, has profound consequences with how we speak to patients with our intonation, how patients hear us in relation to their own early history. And one little example that I came across recently was Beethoven, who felt that his mother had no sense of pleasure in life, in having a baby, and an atmosphere of profound displeasure surrounded baby Beethoven, which in time is something that he was able to gain mastery of in, for instance, the Ode to Joy, where there's a huge amount of Stormy Drang, and eventually there's a profound breaking through to say, there is joy. This is not my mother, this is me.
Thank you, all of you, for lots to think about. I'd like to address my comments to Ken Robinson as well. Great talk, I loved it. You brought up Kant's referral to the conceptual and empirical and critique of pure reason. Now, what he suggested, though, was that the combination of the conceptual and the empirical results in the transcendental thought, which I believe he also called common sense. And I think this is what we sort of lose when we go into training, that we learn lots of concepts and we're exposed to a lot of empirical observations, but they sometimes don't go together to create the transcendental thought, and we lose the common sense. And so then I guess our task after we've been dubbed analysts is to refine our common sense.
I was very happy to hear Ken Robinson apply Michael Polanyi to the Freud-Ferenczi relationship. And it occurred to me that maybe not everybody is familiar with how close a link was between the Polanyi family and, would you like to say? And Ferenczi. First of all, the mother was mentioned at least three times in Ferenczi-Freud correspondence. She had been analyzed in Zurich, I'm not sure by whom. And she kept a court of interesting people in Budapest, including Ferenczi. The daughter, Laura, was analyzed by both Ferenczi and Freud. He sent her to Freud. And in their correspondence, they referred to her as the girl with the beautiful eyes. And brother Karol Polanyi and Michael together founded an intellectual group called the Galileo Circle. Incidentally, Matyáš Rákosi was the treasurer of that that group in his youth, and Karl was the president, and Ferenczi gave a talk to them about psychoanalysis at least on two occasions. So, thank you. Yeah, big foot, long footnote, yeah. I don't think...
Just a brief comment about the differences in analytic style between Freud and Ferenczi. I'm very involved now in reading materials about Freud's patients and also supervise a doctoral dissertation about several of his patients. And I think the picture that emerges is that there was not much of a difference in terms of a natural style, spontaneous style. Freud was never a blank screen analyst. Many of his principles about being a blank screen were hypothetical. They did not stem from his actual behavior. I think the big difference, in my view, is that Freud was much more defensive. When confronted by criticisms from his patients, he usually brushed it off, very rarely got into his own countertransference, very rarely was willing to accept that maybe he was not friendly to a patient or critical of a patient. I think there his defensiveness and maybe lack of real interest in countertransference made a very big difference from Ferenczi.
Yes, I think that it's important also, and that was mentioned, the political aspect of Freud. He had his baby to defend in a drastic way. And I think that really emerges in the clinical diary and how, you know, Ferenczi took the other side. But Freud, I think, never ever really left his political responsibility, which, you know, how do we take that into account? Of course, I think today's session to me made me think of our analytical societies, you know? I mean, it's amazing. I had just been to a conference in Paris, which I decided I would never go to a conference like that again, because there nothing happened. It's so bloqué, you know, it's all verrouillé, they say in French. And nothing, but nothing. And even people were talking about translation, the new translation of Freud. And they didn't talk about it because it has such implications. The French translation of Freud, when you translate Hilflosigkeit, into Desert. They didn't talk about the fact that German is an agglutinated language like Hungarian, where you can stick things together, and French isn't. And so they, and all these implications, I think they just are very, what is the honesty? How can we be honest in the political system of psychoanalytical societies?
Thank you. First of all, thank you for the footnotes. That's wonderful. I had a bit of a footnote, but not as good as yours. and another bit of my paper is what you were talking about. Looking back to Jonathan, actually, I think Jonathan, I mean, I'm not sure I like the language of the master is Polanyi's. And in some sense it works, I think. But I think that one of the things that I was trying to indicate that should be picked up if things go well enough is actually the freedom to be different. Yeah. The freedom to be authentic, which means actually being one's own person and not, so you give your bill in whatever way, means whatever, but it's not necessarily the same as the analyst. So I think that's a terribly important part of the the unspoken ambiance of the analysis of that. But on translation, I think it's so interesting that, you know, there's a sort of new standard edition going to come out, but it's not a new translation. It's a tinkering with the, and of course the Strachey for years we've recognized is, it really misleads as on Freud in English, especially on empathy, actually. The Strachey's hated the term empathy, thought it was an elephantine word and should be avoided at all costs. So they only use it, empathy, in the standard edition when it refers to psychology. But when it's an analytic term, they try and find something else. So there's a huge confusion in the English translation, which we won't talk about adequately. I mean, people have tried. Ricardo Stein has tried, and Ornstein in the States has tried, but it's never actually come to anything substantial. Yeah.
I just wanted to add a word about this discussion of Freud fantasy, which in our circles comes very often up, and that's, you can understand. I don't think we should concentrate of how Freud was really. It's not a question of Freud in so-called reality, whatever that means. But it is a question how in Ferenczi's fantasy Freud was, as his father and Freud, all these men who were very disappointing and not recognizing his merits. And on the other side also, Freud with his pupils, but it was that, where he can write, for instance, in Ferenczi, you would not recognize that I am the father. He's not writing, you see in me the father. He's writing, I am the father. I mean, this kind of confusion between reality and fantasy, even by these very important persons, I think we should always remember. Because I would say to Emmanuel, it is not only the question how Freud really behaved, but it was also the question how Ferenczi thought that not shaking hands between Wiesbaden is a repetition, what he always lived through, that the father is not recognizing what he is doing.
I think my question is for Gabor, maybe. I can't think. I just was very interested in the idea of honesty. It was all such an interesting morning, and there's a kind of a... What came to my mind as sort of, I don't know, even a... I don't, just an image, was an aesthetics lecture I was at many years ago, where forgeries of paintings tend to be indistinguishable from the original, good forgeries, at the time that they're done. But the fact that it's a forgery becomes apparent later, because something has changed in the culture, and the thing that the forger saw, that everyone else saw at the time, then 50 years later isn't there in the way that people see. And I'm wondering about this very interesting thing of the growth of the activity in small groups changing the way that we learn and think. And there's something in the culture that's more democratic, and we all do tweeting and blogging and these things. And so there's something... I'm just wondering if honesty, like when you're honest, you pick on something to say, but you don't say something else. But the way that you choose is not necessarily your personal choice somehow. There's an external influence, a hegemonic or some strange influence in how you feel and think to choose what to say and what not to say, is my question. Thank you.
I very much agree with you. I think that it's a major topic, not for this, that how small group was taken throughout the history of psychoanalysis. And one of the reasons is that Freud was, disappointed with the small group situations he experienced as an organization. And it's always mixed up the organization, a small group with small groups. And Ferenczi was disappointed with small groups. And Ferenczi, the most honest person, was such a political intrigue in setting up the Hungarian society like everyone all over the world. While Balint was the first from the Hungarians who really started to work with small groups. But I just think that there is something going on which we do not realize yet what it will bring.
And now I have to apologize from you and ask you to hold it till the next session because, these thoughts and ideas and feelings continue. And I ask you to come back by 4:40. Now we'll have a coffee break, not to give John Raphael Leff a hard time, who will facilitate the second part of the morning session. Thank you for this brilliant panel. Thank you.